First and Second Samuel, tape 12.
Only two books because of the length. Now, in a very survey kind of a way, we've looked at the message of 1 Samuel. And so this evening we begin 2 Samuel. And I think it's necessary, as I see it, and I've really wrestled with this. The fact is, it wasn't until 4 o'clock this afternoon when I decided to teach it. 2 Samuel is a book of tremendous facts. Now, my teaching, as you probably noticed, is designed to give principles. We've got to look at the spiritual teaching underneath the facts. God has put great truths of God underneath the facts. And in most places in the Bible, it's easy to get the principles because the facts are at least vaguely familiar. That is, if we study the stay in Egypt, or the Red Sea, or the wilderness, or the judges, or the fiery furnace, or the lion's den, then all you got to do is brush up on the facts and dive into the principle. You could spend a lot of time on the principle. But when we come to 2 Samuel, it's not a message of brushing up on facts. At least it's not in my own life, because you can't brush up on facts you never heard. And for the most part, 2 Samuel is a brand new book to me. Now, I've read it before, but it has never gripped my heart as it's begun to grip my heart. And you can't brush up on stories that you're not familiar with. I really believe that the principles are going to be bruised by our ignorance of the facts if I don't take the time to give the facts. I regret that I have to do it. I almost feel guilty about this. But I just want to tell the facts tonight, without principles, without spiritual application. And that can be boring, but I really, honestly, I've held this before the Lord. I think it's necessary. There are so many names and so many different places and so much intrigue and so many wars and so much overlapping truth and so much background in 2 Samuel that in order to get and enjoy the principles later, we have to plow through this. And so I ask for your patience with me and to bear along as I give these facts. Now, I don't expect you to remember what I'm going to give you tonight. That's not the purpose of it. Matter of fact, I think that's impossible. All I want you to do is hear it and just try to enjoy it. Sit back and try to enjoy it. I'm going to tell you the whole book of 2 Samuel as a connected story. And it's not given as a connected story. You got to jump here and there and everywhere and tie it all together. But I believe if we get the story before us, all 24 chapters, then when we come to the principles, it'll be more meaningful to us. So I want to give you the story of David's reign as far as 2 Samuel carries it. So at least you can say, yes, I heard that story before once last week when you gave it. Now, I'm far more concerned with following the story than I am with the correct pronunciation of certain names and all. And I'm sure, as I have been in the past, I'll be criticized for not looking up all the names and getting the accurate pronunciation. Well, so be it. The names aren't that important to me because I want to get the story, I want to get the facts so that later we can look at the principles. So in one sense, I'm apologizing because I'm not going to give principles this evening. And yet, in another sense, I'm not apologizing because I really believe this is important, this is necessary, okay? And knowing the Lord, as I've begun to know Him, He'll probably use this lesson more in your life than those where I think I've given certain principles that are going to be applicable to your life. Anyway, I hope you follow the connected story. I hope you enjoy the stories, and I hope it does prepare you for the days ahead when we look at it. I do believe it'll be a preparation. It's like Solomon's temple. Before you have the spiritual temple, you got to gather the materials. So that's what we're going to do this evening. With that in mind, let's begin. There are 24 chapters in 2 Samuel. The story begins with the death of Saul, and it ends with David, a 70-year-old man, making one of the biggest mistakes in his 40-year reign, numbering the people of Israel for military purposes. I'm not going to try to give you the outline tonight, or the recurring emphasis, or the key chapters, or the key verses or passages, or the revelations of Christ. We're going to look at that, but not this evening. Tonight we want to look at the story. We've seen the failure of man's king, Saul. We've seen the training of God's king, David. And now, in 2 Samuel, we're going to look at the enthronement of God's king. I'll begin the story at the end of 1 Samuel. David has repented of seeking refuge in the camp of the Philistines. Remember, he went to Ziklag. And God's chastening in his life worked. David was reduced to ashes. He saw the futility of human safeties and human havens. And now he awaits the outcome of word how the war between the Philistines and the Israelites was doing, which by God's marvelous providence he was absent. An Amalekite comes to David, a man who sees the tide turning toward the exaltation of David, and he reasons in his heart, I'm going to win royal rewards. I'm going to win David's favor. Now, evidently, by accident, he happened upon Saul's dead body. Remember, Saul committed suicide. He fell upon his own sword. And this man comes upon Saul's body, sees the royal insignia, the evidence that he was king, his crown and some other things, and he robs the body. Then he thinks David is going to bless God for this man who has killed, so he'll lie, who has killed the king's enemy. And so he comes to David and he lies and he says, I killed Saul and here's proof. Here's his crown. Here's his royal insignia. And then he waits for David to praise him. Well, he gets a reward, all right. He knew very little about David's magnanimous heart and his attitude toward Saul. You've slain the Lord's anointed? How could you lift up a sword against the Lord's anointed? And before he could answer, he was laying dead in his own blood. He told a lie and he never had a chance to talk his way out of it. Then follows one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry in the Bible. David's pathetic lament when he finds out that Saul and his son Jonathan were dead. How the mighty have fallen. David's heart is really manifest in the words of that particular song. But life goes on. David calls upon the Lord for his next step. The war is over. The Philistines have defeated Israel. Saul is dead. His sons are dead, at least some of them. And David asks, what shall I do? God gives an immediate answer. Go to Hebron, the city of refuge. And so David obeys, he and his 600 men with all of their families, and they make their way to Hebron. But God had gone before and worked in the hearts of the tribe of Judah, one of the 12 tribes, the messianic tribe, the tribe from which David came. And they're waiting for him. David is now 30 years old. It's 12 years after he was anointed by God through Samuel to be the king. And now when he arrives in Hebron, they anoint him king over Judah. Now to catch the intrigue of what follows, let me introduce a few personages to you. I'll let you know who wears the white hat, who wears the black hats, who's the good guys, who's the bad guys. You got to know if they're friend or foe. First, let me tell you about David's men. For this part of the story, David had a very important man. His name was Joab. We're going to read about him all through 2 Samuel. Joab, at this time, was the chief captain in David's army, one of his mighty men. Joab had two brothers. I won't take time to spell them for you. Abishai and Ashiel. Ashiel is famous because the Bible says he could run like a deer. Very, very fast. These three brothers were not ordinary brothers. They were really close. You don't touch one without touching the other. Keep that in mind because that's what happens in the story. Joab was David's right-hand man. That was his captain in the army, the leader of all the forces that he had. Of course, at this time, he didn't have many forces. On the other side, though Saul was dead, we haven't heard the last of Saul's family. It's true that two of Saul's sons died in the battle with Saul, but there were at least three more sons that didn't die. I think two of them were too young to go to battle. And the third one, we don't know exactly what was wrong with him, but he had some kind of an infirmity. Evidently, he was born with it because his name means weakness, man of weakness, man of shame. And I'm talking about Eshbaal, better known as Ishbosheth. Okay? Ishbosheth is Saul's son. And he's not only weak physically, but he's weak morally as well. And he doesn't have too much moxie on how to run a government either. Anyway, Ishbosheth, we'll start another one, here's Saul's family. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, also has an army. David is reigning over one tribe, Ishbosheth, over 11, there's 12 tribes altogether, over 11 tribes. Ishbosheth has a man like Joab, only his name is Abner. And he's the right-hand man of Ishbosheth. He takes a prominent place in the story. David is king of Judah, and he has these three leaders of his army. They're commanders. Saul's family doesn't give up that easily. Abner, the commander of Saul's army, rouses up the 11 tribes and says, come on now, just because Saul is dead, are you going to give up the whole kingdom? Let's crown his son king. And so that's what they do. They go to a place called Menahem, and they crown Ishbosheth king. Now you've got two kings. You got David as king over Judah, and you got Ishbosheth as king over the 11 tribes of Israel. Really, he wasn't reigning. Abner was reigning. He was just a figurehead. And Abner was the one pulling all the strings. Well, it went that way for about 2 years. David, though God had anointed him to be king over everything, as usual, doesn't take one step to affect it in his life. He just waits and lets it happen. At the end of 2 years, Abner feels his oats a little bit, and he goes to Ishbosheth and he says, you know, I think we can overtake David. He's only got a little army and he's only ruling over one tribe. I think we can overpower him. We can take over. Because he's full of desire and because he's full of pride, he takes his army and he decides to go down and attack David and his army. David has a small army, but he has some very valiant men, especially Joab. And evidently the news traveled pretty fast because Joab heard that they were on their way down. So Joab, along with his other two brothers, rouse up their army and they meet together at a pool called the Pool of Gibeon. Well, it's been a long time since Judah and Israel got together, and they look in each other's eyes, one army here, and they say, what are we doing? We're brothers. Why are we gathering to a civil war? Why are we fighting like this? Well, Abner was getting excited, and he said, attack, attack, kill, because he wanted a war. But Joab was trying to talk him out of it. We shouldn't be fighting like this. We're brothers. And so they come to a strange compromise. Each side will choose 12 of their most valiant men, their strongest men, not unlike the contest of Goliath in the Valley of Elah. 24 men will engage in battle, and the winning side will be conquerors, and the other side will supposedly surrender. And so 12 men are chosen from David's army under Joab, and 12 men are chosen from Ish-bosheth's army under Abner. And they are valiant, and they are swift. So valiant and so swift that within 5 minutes, all 24 are dead. They all kill each other. When the two armies see that their champions are laying in pools of blood, they both got angry and raged in conflict against each other, and one of the greatest civil wars that Israel's ever known took place. A tremendous battle ensued, and when the dust settled, the army of Abner was on the run. The army of Joab, Ashiel, and Abishai had been conquerors. Well, the army of Joab didn't give up that easy, and they began to chase Abner, and pretty soon everyone was either dead or scattered. And in the chase, Ashiel, the one the Bible says could run like a deer, when everybody's running every which way, Ashiel spots Abner on the run. And so Ashiel takes off after Abner. And it didn't take long before he caught up to him. So Abner looks over his shoulder and sees Ashiel and knows that he's Joab's brother. And he knows if he kills Joab's brother, he's in bad trouble. Because not only are these three brothers very close, but there's a law in Israel that says the brother is responsible to avenge the death, the manslayer, to avenge the death of anyone who kills his brother. And so Abner tries to talk Ashiel out of it. He says, "Stop pursuing me. Why should I kill you? We're brothers. Remember your little sermon back there?" But it doesn't work, and Ashiel keeps up and keeps up. Now the swords in those days were dangerous at both ends. Not only the blade of the sword, but the other end had a long metal spike on it, the handle, which was put into the ground when the soldier was in repose, when he went to sleep. And so Abner took the butt end of his sword as Ashiel chased him and just drove it back. It went right through Ashiel. And Ashiel dies. Abner kills Ashiel. Well, the news of that soon got to Joab and Abishai, and they weren't very happy. And they began to pursue Abner and what was left of the army. And they continued the chase until sunset, and by that time, Abner had run to the borders of Benjamin. Now that's one of these tribes. And so when Benjamin saw that it was one of his guys, all the men of Benjamin came together and got into a circle around Abner and says, "Go ahead, touch him." Well, Joab wasn't about to get into another war. His men were tired. It was getting dark. And so he backs off. He thinks it's prudent to return. So he calls his army off. Joab, Abishai, go back to Hebron where David is. Abner and what's left of his army goes back to Menahem where Ish-bosheth is king. They tally up the results. Israel lost 360 men in the fight. Judah lost 19 in the whole fight. Not very many men. Well, that conflict between the two kingdoms lasted for several years. There was never another great confrontation like that first one. Not a great civil war. Not like at the Pool of Gibeon. Ish-bosheth is such a poor king that the people are beginning to get dissatisfied and their hearts start leaning toward David. They look at Judah and how it's prospering and they say, "Well, I wish we had a king like that. We don't like the king that we have." And Abner's doing his best to make it a good kingdom and he's pulling all the strings. Ish-bosheth is so proud he thinks he's reigning. But really Abner's the one that's doing it all. So increasingly, the hearts of the men of Israel are turning toward David, son of Jesse. Well, David was prospering in more ways than military force and popular opinion. During his stay in Hebron, he accumulates 6 more wives. 2 Samuel gives us the list of their names and their firstborn sons. I'm not going to take the time now to give you those facts. Only 2 children become prominent in the story of 2 Samuel. A couple of others take place in 1 Kings. But the 2 that become prominent in 2 Samuel are the children of Maachah, the princess of Geshur, wife of David. One of his wives' name was Maachah. You recognize the children more than you'll recognize the wife. Absalom, the beauty with the long hair, and his sister Tamar. Well, whether polygamy is prosperity or not, the rest of the story will tell. While David's prospering in the south, there's more political trouble in the north. Ish-bosheth and his captain are not getting along too well. They begin to have inner struggles. Evidently, what happened was Abner took Rizpah, Saul's concubine wife, which by heredity was passed on to Ish-bosheth. In other words, he took one of his wives and had criminal intercourse with her. And Ish-bosheth, even though he was weak, he was brave. And he goes to Abner and he says, "What is this that you've done? You're a wicked man." And Abner says, "What? What are you saying to me? After all I've done for you, I've given you the kingdom. Everything that, every victory you have, I'm the one that set you up as king. I talked the 11 tribes into putting you up here. And what are you mouthing off to me that I've committed some sin for? Everything you have, you owe to me." And Abner got so angry, he said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do, you so-and-so. I'm going to join forces with David. And I'm going to build up his kingdom. I'm a mighty man and I don't want to waste it on you. God's anointed David to be king. I'm going to desert and go to David." And so he does. Under the pretense of being highly insulted, he makes plans for his mutiny. But now he's got to make himself agreeable to David, and that's not an easy chore. So as a gift of his sincerity, he brings one of David's old wives, Michal, daughter of Saul, who was stolen from him in 1 Samuel, remember. And David's so glad to see Michal, he's glad to see Abner. "All right, I got another wife." And so now David has his 7th wife, and it's a good thing that Joab wasn't in town when Abner showed up, because he wasn't too happy about losing his brother Ashiel. You see why we got to get these facts? So anyway, David, whether it was politics or sincerity, I'm not sure, but he receives Abner with tremendous distinction, with pomp, and he's royally feasted. Meanwhile, Joab comes home. And when Joab returns and he hears that Abner has come into the kingdom, he can't believe it. And he marches right into the Oval Office and chews David out and says, "What in the world are you doing? You trust that guy? He's a spy. His heart is for Ish-bosheth. He's just trying to find a way to come in and destroy everything. Don't believe him." But David couldn't be persuaded. And he said, "Nah, he really means it. He's going to be on our side. La, la, la." So Joab decides to take matters into his own hands. Now the law says that the brother of a slain man becomes the avenger of blood and has the right to take the life of the one who killed his brother if that man was not in a city of refuge. There were 6 cities of refuge. Unfortunately, Hebron was a city of refuge, and so Joab could not touch Abner without fear of being prosecuted, as a murderer, unless he could get him out of Hebron. And so he waited. And one day, Abner stepped outside the gate. And guess who was waiting for him? indeed, Joab. And in the name of his dead brother, he takes his sword and drives it through his heart, and he's dead. It was all legal. It was all custom. Public opinion expected it, and it could not be punished as a crime. It was the law of God. It did, however, put David in a rather embarrassing situation with King Ishbosheth, because this man now was murdered. He had supposedly come in peace, and now he was dead. To wash his hands of the deed, David publicly rebuked Joab. David made a public declaration of his own innocence. David held a big state funeral for Abner, himself being the chief mourner, and he made dear old Joab a pallbearer. Well, that didn't help too much with his relationship with Joab. Politically, it was probably one of the wisest moves that David ever had, because the 11 tribes said, "What a man. Oh, we only had a king like that. What a tremendous king he is." They were really impressed. Of course, without Abner now, Ishbosheth is nothing. He was nothing before. But every day he's beginning to lose the favor of the people. And it was a growing conviction that the son of Saul could not govern. And all the hearts were bending toward David, the only person that could bring it all together. Well, the officers of Ishbosheth's dwindling army soon saw that their days were numbered, and so they tried to do what the Amalekite had done. They waited for an unsuspecting moment. They snuck into Ishbosheth's room, and they murdered him. They proceeded then to take off his head and make their way to the city of Hebron. They walked into the Oval Office and offered the head of Ishbosheth, "David, we've destroyed your enemy." Well, David responds again as he did in Saul's case, and those two assassins were quickly put to death as well. David holds another state funeral and buries Ishbosheth with Abner. And now they're both buried. That leaves Israel without a king. 7.5 years David had reigned in Jerusalem. I look at this board and I wonder if you know what's going on. 7.5 years David reigned in Hebron, in Judah. And now his life is going to be tremendously changed. The elders of Israel get together representing the 11 tribes, and they hold a big meeting. They call up David. They invite him to come down. "How would you like to enlarge your kingdom?" they say. "We'd like you to reign over us." David accepts the invitation. A tremendous inauguration takes place. 340,000 people show up. A tremendous party, tremendous feasting. 20 years after God had anointed him, David is accepted by the people, and he becomes the king of Israel. The first act of David as the reigning king was to make Jerusalem the new capital. Now that was hard to do because there were enemies in Jerusalem. And so he took his army. Now Joab has been advanced to the commander-in-chief of all the armies. And he takes this army and he goes. At that time it wasn't called Jerusalem, it was called Jabus. And he goes to Jabus and he drives out the enemy. And Jerusalem, later called the City of David, because there on Mount Zion he built himself a palace, built many buildings, made his own residence there. And so he sets up his kingdom in Jerusalem. Well, his reign was not to be a reign of peace. Though the civil war was over, the internal strife was done, there were many surrounding nations who were going to be unfriendly to this new king and this new kingdom. The first attack was made by the Philistines. They saw everything happening, and so suddenly did they want to overpower them, so unexpectedly that they just attacked Bethlehem. And within a year of David's reign, he's on the run again. And he runs, he leaves Jerusalem, and he hides in the cave of Adullam. Remember that? That's where he was with Saul. This is where that marvelous story took place. David longed for the waters of Bethlehem. And remember his three mighty men, Joab and Jeshbeam and Eliezer. They run down, they just heard his sigh, oh, that I could have water from the wells of Bethlehem. And they break through the host of the Philistine. At the jeopardy of their lives, they bring back the water. And David said, I can't drink this. It's the water of blood. It was at too high a price, and he pours it out on the ground as a thank offering to God. Well, anyway, from the cave of Adullam, David bows before God and asks God, what should I do? And God tells him what to do. And oh, it's a marvelous victory. And David, with his little army from that cave of Adullam, goes out and wins an effective victory. The Philistines were a tremendous sword, a thorn in the side of Israel for many years. As you know, the Philistines, Philistines, Philistines. This battle from the cave of Adullam broke their arm. And they only rose up against one more time in the history of Israel, and they were all done. And it was because of this tremendous victory. So David goes back to Jerusalem, and now he's even more exalted than he was before. David realizes that his kingdom is more than a kingdom of men. It's a theocracy, a theocratic constitutional monarchy. God is king. He's been reigning now for 10 years. 7.5 years over one tribe, 2.5 years over the whole nation. And now he makes plans to bring God into the picture publicly. Remember the ark? Now he's going to go get the ark and bring the ark back to Jerusalem. He goes up to Mount Zion and he builds this tremendous tabernacle to hold it. He has a special service all planned, and he goes to bring the ark. He's going to make Jerusalem not only the political capital, but the spiritual capital as well. On the way, en route, the ark was on a cart, remember? And it was over a bumpy road, and it began to be jostled. And a man named Uzzah reached his hand out to steady the ark. And as soon as he touched it, God struck him dead. That put an end to that party. The joy was over, the pomp was over, and a fearsome awe fell on everybody. David calls off the celebration and sends the ark away to the house of a man called Edom-Obed. He leaves it there for 3 months. Waiting to see if lightning strikes him. Nothing happens. Only blessing. Only benediction. And finally, David says, we'll try again. This time we're going to be more careful. This time he reads in his Bible in Exodus how you're supposed to handle that ark. And he gets the priests and he gets the poles and he makes them carry it between their shoulders like they were supposed to in the first place. No irreverence this time. And so the priests begin to bring the ark. And what a solemn day it was. That ark in the shape of a throne, symbolizing the kingship of God. David takes off his kingly robe and lays it in front of the ark. Same as to say, I'm not the king. You're the king. And then David, having laid off that, puts on a plain white robe similar to the linen garments that the priests wore. And he began to shout, and he began to sing, and he began to play his harp. And he began to dance in front of the ark. And he made himself one with the people. The sound of that procession could be heard for many, many miles. As he approached the holy city, from the window of the palace was Michelle, Saul's daughter, David's wife. She looks out the window. She remembers what a king was. She remembers her father, King Saul. And now she looks at King David, dressed up in a robe of common people, jumping up and down like a fool, yelling at the top of his lungs. And she was embarrassed to be the wife of King David. She said, what indignity is this? He's a king and he's acting like this. And when David came in at night, She rebuked him to his face. What did you do? You embarrassed the whole kingdom. And he said, it was before God that I humbled myself. Well, Michelle was cursed with the curse of barrenness. She wasn't allowed to have children because of that attitude of her heart. Now that the ark was in Jerusalem, the spiritual life of God's people begun, David decided that he'd build a temple to the Lord. David found himself with a little problem. Instead of having one high priest, he had two high priests. Saul had killed all the priests, remember, at Nob. And so Saul was left without a priest. And so he appointed Zadok to be the priest. But there was one surviving priest that ran to be with David, remember. And his name was Ahimelech. So now David has two high priests, Ahimelech and Zadok. Hope you remember all this because it's very important. David used both high priests, but of course he favored the God-appointed one, Ahimelech. And so it went for the next 5 years or so. He had set up orderly worship. People were coming now to the tabernacle. They were worshiping before God. David's elegant palace had been finished, and now his heart began to be burdened for a house of God. He shared his burden with his favorite prophet, Nathan. And he said, I want you to pray for me. I want to build God a house. It's not right that I should live in this luxurious palace when God doesn't have a house. Nathan greatly encouraged him. Do it, David, do it. But favorite prophets can be wrong. And Nathan was wrong. And God came to Nathan in a revelation. And he said, tell David he's not allowed to build me a house. And he told Nathan a bunch of other things to tell, the greatest of which was a play on words. David said, I want to build you a house. And God said, I'm going to build you a house. You will be my house, and I'll live in you. And when David heard the plans that God had for him and his seed, his children and his children's children, when he heard that Christ was going to come through his line and establish a kingdom that would never be destroyed, the Bible says that David got down on his face and he worshiped before God. The next few years were bloody years for David's kingdom. They were years of war. Victory over the Philistines, victory over the Ammonites, victory over the Moabites, victory all the way east to the Euphrates, south to the Red Sea. David conquered king after king and became, on the level of earth, little k, the King of Kings. Very important fact that we'll pick up when we get to the spiritual message. He conquered the king of Zobah, the king of Syria, the king of the Edomites, the king of the Ammonites, the king of Hammon, the king of Tyre. All of them were defeated. The spoils were so great they couldn't be computed. Horses and chariots and golden shields, brass and silver and gold without number. All kinds of timber and jewels and everything. And so David prospered. His kingdom grew and grew, became more and more prosperous, and it wasn't long before there were no more kings to conquer. Oh, they were going to rise up again, but at this point, there was a measure of peace and quiet. The spiritual life was established. The government was now established. David sat on his throne and began to remember. He looked around and he saw his kingdom, and it was so prosperous and it was so rich. And he remembered the days of running through the forest from Saul. And he remembered the days of his good friend Jonathan. And when he thought of Jonathan, he remembered a day in a field where he had made a vow with Jonathan that if he ever got to be exalted as king, he would never forget the family of Jonathan. And he remembered that with a start, and he sent word out through his kingdom, see if Jonathan has any more family that I might bless them. And so he begins to inquire, and he finds out, yes, Jonathan does have family. He has a son, a crippled son. A boy who was crippled on the day of his father's death, when Jonathan died. A nurse, because of that war, was running for safety. And she was holding the little baby in her arms. And as she ran out, she tripped and stumbled, and both legs of the baby were broken, and they were never set. And so the baby grew up with deformed legs and became crippled. His name was Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan. David called for Mephibosheth, brought him to the royal palace. He was afraid. He thought because he was Saul's son, or Jonathan's son, Saul's grandson, that he was going to be destroyed. But David explained that though, now those of you who can think spiritually, think. David explained that though he was crippled in the fall and was born in the wrong kingdom, yet he would be accepted in the beloved and brought into a relationship and inheritance with the King of Kings. And so because of Jonathan, he was made to be a millionaire. He was given land. He was given servants. Ziba, the liar, the hypocrite, Ziba was made the head servant of Mephibosheth. And from that day on, Mephibosheth never ate a meal that wasn't at David's table. He always ate at David's table because he was accepted in Jonathan. There was another one David remembered, but it didn't turn out so well as Mephibosheth. He remembered Nahash, the king of Ammon, who showed kindness to him when he was fleeing from Saul. And so he decided to return that kindness, but before he got to do that, Nahash died. And so he decided, well, what I'll do is I'll send an embassy to the funeral, and I'll reward his son. His son's name was Hanum. And he said, I'll give everything to Hanum that I was going to give to Nahash. When the embassy arrived at the funeral, they were arrested as spies. And when they were arrested as spies, they were shamefully treated. Their beards were cut off, and you have the first mention of miniskirts in the Bible. Their robes were cut to their thighs, and they were required to go back in shame, no beards, in their miniskirts. Well, when David heard about that, he was irate. Joab gathered an army, and he was all set to go to war and destroy those Ammonites who had done such a thing. The men were intercepted and they were allowed to go to Jericho till they got new robes and their beards grew back. Joab gathers his army and goes to war again. The Ammonites, who knew that they were coming, hired the Syrians. Those are the first mercenaries mentioned in history. They paid these Syrians to join them in fight. This was the first of three campaigns that these two brothers, Joab and Abishai, would go on. The first was easy, and it was an easy victory. The second one was against Syria and Assyria. And that was a tough one, and David went himself and won that battle. 40,000 were killed, but finally they were subdued. The third campaign, well, that was made very famous because David didn't go out on that one. He stayed home, looked out a window. All right, you know the story I'm talking about. In an evil and in an unguarded moment, his desires brought him very, very low. I refer to the Bathsheba story. Of all the stories in 2 Samuel, I think all of us have at least some knowledge of the Bathsheba story. David and Bathsheba, the death of Uriah, the rebuke by Nathan, the death of the baby. And so to save time, I'm going to jump over all of those chapters that deal with that. I think you know that story. I only point out this, that at that time, it's the 18th year of David's reign as king, and he's 48 years old. It's the first half of 2 Samuel. It takes you to chapter 12. I told you there's a lot of facts. Let me go on a little. The second half of the book of 2 Samuel opens with Joab. He's gone crazy now with war. He's moving on from victory to victory. His greatest victory was over Rabbah, a city called Rabbah, where he stole the king's crown. And so splendid was that crown, it was made of solid gold and bedecked with all kinds of precious jewels, that David decided to use that as his own crown. And ever after that, that was the crown of King David in Israel. Of course, that really exalted Joab to a high position,
And so now he is the highest man in the land next to David.
Well, all was going well for David now in the country, but all wasn't going too well in the family. Oh, he had a hard time in his family. Since David had so many wives and so many children by so many wives, there was an awful lot of bickering and jealousy in the family. David's eldest son was named Amnon. A-M-N-O-N. He was a passionate man. One day he burned in desire for his half-sister, Tamar, Absalom's sister. She refused to yield to his passion, and so he forcibly raped her and then cast her out of the house. Weeping and ashamed and humbled, she ran to Absalom for refuge. The news of his daughter's rape soon reached the ears of King David. He was grieved, but he didn't lift one finger to do anything to his eldest son. Now don't forget, according to human laws, his eldest son was the heir to the crown. This made Absalom, the half-brother of Amnon, not only bitterly hating Amnon, but it had increased his resentment toward his father, David. Absalom let that smolder for about 2 years. And then he calls a tremendous feast, a sheep-shearing feast at Baal Hazor. And he invites the royal family. Obviously, King David is too busy. He can't go. But all the other sons go. Absalom waits until all the sons of David are seated around the table. It's a big party. Then he turns to his right and nods to his servants. And Absalom's servants rise up, walk over to Amnon, and cut him down in cold blood right at the party. Absalom knows that he better beat feet, and he does. And he runs away, and he flees to his maternal grandfather's house, Talmai, the king of Geshur. Absalom stays there for 3 years. Meanwhile, Joab is doing everything in his power to effect a reconciliation between David and his son Absalom, who is now the eldest son and heir to the throne on the level of earth. Finally, he talks David into bringing Absalom back from Geshur. So, Joab's all excited. He brings Absalom back. And meanwhile, David had a chance to think about it. He said, I won't see him. And he didn't see him for 2 years. And Joab is constantly, come on, David, that's your son and blah, blah. And finally, they get together. Hugs, kisses, embraces, forgiveness, the whole bit. On the outside. The last 5 years, Absalom had been making some very serious plans to overthrow the kingdom of his own father. Let me give you a couple of items of background here that'll help drive home the point. According to the laws of earth, Absalom was the heir to the throne because he was the oldest. But this wasn't an ordinary kingdom. This was a theocratic constitutional monarchy. This was God's kingdom. And according to the laws of God's kingdom, it didn't matter who was the oldest son. The one became king who God appointed. And God had made it known that the one who would reign would be called Man of Peace. The word Man of Peace means Solomon. And Absalom knew he was not in line for the throne. Right, that didn't help. The second piece of background is this, that the judicial system in those Oriental kingdoms was this. It was the duty of the Oriental king to administer justice in person. In other words, if you had some kind of a gripe, you'd go to the king. And the king would say, here's how we dispose of it. There were other judges, inferior judges. But of course, everybody wanted to go to the king. And you could see how that would tie up his schedule. So David made a decision that I don't know how wise it was. But his decision was that he'd set up hours. You could come to me during these hours, otherwise I'll be administering state. I've got work to do. Well, that made him pretty unpopular because not everybody could get in. Some people had to wait months in order to see the king. Now, I tell you that to show Absalom's subtlety.
Absalom was tall, dark, handsome, proud, long-haired man. For those who were judging outward appearance, he was their man. Absalom began to take on more pomp than his office required. He began riding in a chariot. He hired himself a guard of horsemen. He never appeared in public with less than 50 men. Every morning he'd appear at the gate where people came to give their gripes, and he'd say, "You know, if I was king, I'd be listening to your gripes. My father says he's so busy doing all this and that. Oh, if I were only king." And the Bible says, by doing this, he stole the hearts of all Israel. He did that for 4 years, every morning for 4 years, until all of Israel went with him. Well, it was about the 30th year of David's reign as king. He's about 60 years old now. And Absalom decides that the time is ripe for a takeover. He goes to the king and lies about some made-up story of making a vow to give a sacrifice in Hebron when he was estranged from his father in Geshur. And so David gives him permission to go. What happens from here is one of the saddest stories in the Old Testament. Among David's most treasured men were two of his wise counselors. One was named Ahithophel, and the other was named Hushai. Well, Ahithophel, the wisest counselor, joined forces with Absalom. He deserted from David, and because he was the wise counselor, that was very influential, and the hearts of the people who hadn't gone toward Absalom went with Ahithophel. Goes to Hebron, blows the trumpet, and declares he's the new king. Well, David is now a pretty old man. And he turns around, he looks around, he sees he doesn't have many followers. All of a sudden, he was reigning. All of a sudden, everybody's following Absalom, who says he's the new king. So David says, time to run again. And so he gets his family, at least what's left of it. He doesn't want to leave the palace alone, so he takes out of his harem 10 of his concubine wives and says, "You stay and guard the palace or take care of things here. We got to go." And as he leaves, the Bible says he pauses outside by the gate of Jerusalem to survey what he's got left. He doesn't have much left. He's got the two priests, Zadok and Ahimaaz, and their two sons, Jonathan and Ahashablaco, or whatever. He's got a small group of Philistine proselytes that joined up with him. He turned to them, he says, "You better go." He said, "This looks bad, looks like our kingdom's over." And they said, "No, we'll be loyal to you to the end." He still got his 600 men, not really 600, 599. Uriah was now dead, one of his mighty men. And so the Bible says he begins to weep as he leaves Jerusalem. He begins to ascend the Mount of Olives. He takes off his shoes. He covers his head. And he laments in a loud voice that can be heard all over. "Is this what it's come to? Is this my kingdom?" As he gets near the top of the mountain, one of his counselors, Hushai, approaches him, embraces him. "David, I'm still with you." He says, "If you are, go back to Jerusalem and pretend to join forces with Absalom and try to thwart the counsel of Ahithophel." Hushai says, "Don't worry, I'll go back." He turns to the priest. He says, "Why don't you go with him? And you act as spies. And if you hear anything, send your sons out." And on many occasions, they came out at the risk of their lives. It's intriguing, but we'll get into that when we touch Samuel. And so Hushai goes back. He goes a little further. "Oh, I don't like this guy, Ziba." He finds Ziba greets him. This is the servant of Mephibosheth. And Ziba tells a lie. He says, "You know, Mephibosheth, that crippled guy you took in? He joined up with Absalom." That broke David's heart. It was not true. The truth is that Ziba, because that man was crippled, he couldn't come. And Ziba had arranged so he couldn't travel because he was crippled. And David got so angry, he said, all that I gave to Mephibosheth, I now give to you. And that's, of course, what Ziba wanted. He goes a little further, and there's another man that greets him, Shimei. Greets him as an insulter, as a stone thrower, casts vile imprecations at him. Abishai gets angry, and he says, David, let me kill him. David says, no, I'm suffering because of my sin with Bathsheba. God has done this to me. Let him talk. I'll take the abuse. Now, meanwhile, in the house, a lot of facts. Let me just try to wrap all this up. Absalom goes to Jerusalem, and his great counselor, Ahithophel, gives him two pieces of advice. He says, remember the last time you and your father were estranged, and then you got back together? That's not good. You're not supposed to get back together. You're enemies now. You're taking over his kingdom. Do something that he'll never forgive you for. Take your army and rape all of his wives who are guarding the palace. Absalom says, good idea. And does it. Ahithophel says, the next thing you do is give me 10,000 men and let me lead the war. I'll go kill David. And then it's all over. Well, by that time, Hushai comes into the palace and he hears that. And Hushai thwarts the counsel of Ahithophel. And he says, that's not good advice, because remember, you think David's weak, but he's got those 600 men, and you've heard of all of the valor and the stories about them. And Absalom becomes afraid, and he says, yeah, we better not do that. And Ahithophel says, what? You're not going to take my advice? I'm the wisest man in the world. And so he goes and kills himself, because his advice wasn't taken. Well, anyway, the two priests... Hushai tells the priest tells the son runs and tells David, David flees to Menahem. But it's not long when the army of Absalom, under a new leader now, under Amasa, goes to Menahem. David divides up into three groups. Joab is leading one group, Abishai is leading the other group, and since Asahel is dead, he gets another leader called Ittai. And Ittai leads the third group. David calls them together. He says, we're a small army now. Here's what I want you to know. I want you to win the war, but don't kill Absalom. Don't touch my son. Capture him alive. It was a tremendous war. 20,000 die. The Bible says that God killed more in the forest by a storm than the army killed with the sword. God was fighting for David. Riding along, you remember the story, Absalom was on his donkey and he went to an oak tree, and the limb was too short and it got caught in his hair, and the donkey kept going and Absalom's hanging in midair. The captains of David's army come along and they say, don't touch him, we've got him, just like David said. And Joab says, baloney on that. And he takes his sword and he drives it through the heart of Absalom three times and destroys him. Amasa was the captain of the wicked army, Absalom's army. When David finds out what Joab has done, he loses rank, and he sets up the enemy captain, Amasa, in Joab's place. Well, Joab's not too happy with David now. Let me just wrap all this up. Joab ends up killing Amasa and setting himself up, and David is becoming older and older and can't control things anymore. Joab comes to a position where he's controlling everything. The book comes to an end where David says to Joab, number the people. Joab knows that that's wrong, because David has now got a taste for war in his mouth. He doesn't want to find out how many people are in Israel. He wants to see how many strong men he can gain so that he can conquer the world. It went right to his head. Joab tried to talk him out of it, but he couldn't listen. And before all the people are numbered, Joab brings the first number. God speaks to David, smites his heart. And David says, I've sinned by numbering the people. God says, well, I've got to punish you. Here's your choices. 7 years famine,